event members of Congress who had participated in the insurrection against the United States Constitution barred them from holding office and removed them from office. I'm actually aware of a number of people who are organizing around implementing it, and they're asking members of Congress who did take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So the Constitution, if they do in fact live up to that oath, has this 14th Amendment, Section 3, which disqualifies people who participated in an insurrection or gave aid and comfort to anyone who did participate in that insurrection from holding office.
Who should be barred?
On January 6th, 2021, there were actually 120 Republicans who voted to block the count of Pennsylvania and Arizona's electoral votes. And that actually gave aid and comfort and was an act of insurrection.
And if people want more information, where could they go?
They can go to nowmarch.org to find out more. In addition, people can call their member of Congress by calling 202-224-3121. That's the congressional switchboard, and ask for your member of Congress and ask your member of Congress to enforce the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the United States Constitution.
On that note, Myla Reason, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Well, thank you, John. It's been my pleasure.
Likewise.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Intifada here on KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles. My name is David Loy, and on behalf of the Suwannee Region Radio Collective, I would like to wish all our listeners as happy a new year as is possible in this time of ongoing genocide. As we approach the inauguration of a new administration in the White House, may this also be a year for you of struggle and resistance and not passivity and conformism. We will need all the voices that we can get here on KPFK and beyond to resist the incoming authoritarianism that threatens us all here. Today, for our first broadcast of the year, we have decided to rebroadcast one of the many extraordinary interviews that we did during 2024, and we are broadcasting a show originally broadcast on the weekend of Thanksgiving, when traditionally Suwannee Region Radio has always brought together the indigenous people of Palestine and the indigenous people of these United States in an effort to consider the true meaning behind this white supremacist festival of Thanksgiving. But this conversation went far beyond thinking about Thanksgiving to think about what it is to live in the wake of genocide. And we felt it appropriate to rebroadcast this show as our first offering to you for this year. We hope you will enjoy it. And we would like also to thank our friends on Middle Eastern Focus for allowing us the use of their half hour in order to bring you this broadcast. Thank you.
من البدا احتلني وعدا بفكر الدم ممكن يروح سودا واقف بمكان اللي من زمان رسم لي خط وهمي بشوفوش امان كان طاير حمام بنادي بعودا فتخبى وعمل لي من غاز وضباب يوم لرد نداء لبينا النداء مهم القناصة بتسود الشباب بتحدى النيران دخان الكوشوك انا طالق عنان مشونا ومشوك انا عائد لارضي.
Hello and welcome to Radio Intifada, a production of the Suwannee Region Radio Collective that broadcasts and podcasts this weekly review of politics and culture. that brings you the voices of the voiceless from Kolkata to Casablanca here on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, as well as streaming worldwide on kpfk.org. My name is David Lloyd, and I'm a member of the South Asia, West Asia, and Northern Africa, or SWANA Collective, that brings you your weekly half hour of Radio Intifada. My co-host is fellow collective member Rana Sharif. Welcome to the show today, Rana.
Thank you so much, David. On this Sunday, after the so-called Thanksgiving holiday, which celebrates the 19th century myth of Native American generosity toward the Pilgrim settlers in the 17th century, and is immediately followed, of course, by gluttonous consumerism on the aptly named Black Friday, we are hosting a conversation about the meaning and political force of the notion of indigeneity in the United States and the SWANA region that we regularly cover. The ironies could scarcely be more glaring. Settler America celebrates its Thanksgiving at the conclusion of this, quote, what is called National Native American Heritage Month, even as the resource extraction from indigenous lands has accelerated under the outgoing President Joe Biden, who licensed even more extraction of carbon fuels than the previous Trump administration did. And as we shall see with Trump 2.0, a promise of an orgy of drilling and mining on the so-called, quote, public lands. Meanwhile, the U.S. proxy and settler colony of Israel seems poised to use this transition period between these two disastrous administrations to compound its genocidal wars on Gaza and on Lebanon and to accelerate its ongoing program of dispossession, home demolition, and land grabbing in the West Bank. Israel's genocide against the Palestinians, a people whose centuries-old presence in Palestine or Canaan, makes them to all intents and purposes indigenous to the land, promises to intensify. And the support Trump will offer to keeping Benjamin Netanyahu in power with an even more fascist Zionist coalition than ever promises only to accelerate the process of annexation and ongoing ethnic cleansing across historic Palestine.
So today we're going to discuss a number of topics, including the relationship between indigenous activism in Palestine and Native America, with our guests, Ali Hisham Musla and Mark Minch de Leon. How helpful is the concept of indigeneity to either region, given the complexity of patterns of settlement, dispossession, and displacement? How will the return of a Republican president and a Republican majority, slim as it is, to the U.S. House and Senate, and the rise of an openly fascistic Israeli government impact the indigenous populations of both regions? Is it just more of the same? How is it possible to live on beyond genocide? And how can we imagine beyond a decolonized world and the settler nations? How can we imagine beyond the settler nation state form a decolonized world? So our guests today are Ali H. Musla. Ali is a researcher at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. In 2022, he received his PhD from the Department of Political Science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where he taught global politics and alternative futures. He's currently a postdoctoral fellow in the Center for Palestine Studies at Columbia University, where he's working on his first book project, To What Abyss Does the Robot Take the Earth? And Mark Minch de Leon, our second guest, is the director of the California Center for Native Nations and assistant professor of Indigenous Studies in the Department of English at the University of California, Riverside. He's also a founding member of the California Indian Studies and Scholars Association. He earned his PhD in rhetoric at UC Berkeley. His concentrations include Indigenous Studies, Rhetorical Theory, and Narrative and Visual Studies. His forthcoming book, Indigenous in Humanities, California Indian Studies After the Apocalypse, due in fall 2025, looks at the anti-colonial, non-vitalist dimensions of California Indian intellectual and cultural resurgence. Those two books, I'm really totally excited to anticipate their publication. So thank you both. And thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you, David, for the introduction. And Rana, it's great to see you both again. And it's wonderful to meet Ali through this venue.
Yes, lovely to be with you all. Thank you.
It's truly humbling and to be in your presence and to share your brilliance with us today. So thank you again and welcome to the show, Ali and Mark. Since we're starting a conversation here on relations between Palestine and U.S. indigeneity, perhaps I can start by asking you both that vexed question. How helpful is the concept of indigeneity to either region, given the complexity of patterns of settlement, dispossession and displacement. Ali, would you like to start us off?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. It's a difficult question, but I think it's, one way we can take it is that it's a way to analyze our relationship to a particular form of violence. I think that is important. I mean, the discipline, settler colonial studies or indigenous politics, try to do that work, put settler colonies in relationship to each other and study them, not as, distinct phenomena as people would study the world of states, but really as a kind of global, if not planetary, phenomenon that we should try to understand and organize against. That's one way to put it, or understand it or approach it. But another way is to say that there's a relationship that we elect to enter into with kin that we didn't know we had before. And I learned this in Hawaii. You know, a lot of my engagements with friends and family in Hawaii was around, let's say, a comparative analysis of settler colonialism in Palestine and in Hawaii. And often there was this sense that there's some distance between us because of the distinctions or differences between the two settler colonies. And I always wondered if that is really something that should define our relationship to each other. What if, by evoking this indigeneity, we're trying to enter into forms of relationship and produce a certain kind of sociality, right? That is against and also beyond the settler colony. Yeah.
Thank you, Ali. Mark, please.
Yeah, no, I actually want to pick up on what you were just saying, Ali, from the standpoint of sociality. And I'm situated in Southern California right now and at UC Riverside in my office.
No.
And so... And I think like one of the things that is really worth thinking about in relationship to the question of indigeneity across different spaces of settler colonialism, and they're, you know, just incredibly brutal. And I think, I mean, I'm going to draw on David's work here, but like a simplifying system, right? Like this is how I think settler colonialism operates, is to, you know, simplify the types of relationships, these incredibly nuanced social, political forms, languages. I'm just a few miles away from Sherman Indian High School, where generations of my family lost their language as well as their cultures. And so I think that, you know, in terms of thinking about the concept of indigeneity, that for me is, you know, it is an oppositional, antagonistic formation in relationship to settler colonialism. And what is settler colonialism? It's the thing that produces these, you know, European colonial outposts. In this case, we're talking about the United States and Israel, which are both, you know, overtly and explicitly there to produce, you know, a situation where they reproduce Western civilization. As I mean, these are explicit statements. And they do that, you know, in, you know, through the forms of domination and through the forms of, absorbing that difference, right, in order to sort of like find ways to self-indigenize, you know, to become the new sort of indigenous populations. You know, and so I think that that notion of thinking about how to talk about indigeneity across these, you know, sort of different situations requires a very different angle of perception, right? Like we can't, you know, like, I think, Ali, your point about, you know, the difficulties of comparison is appropriate, because oftentimes comparison comes from that sort of top-down kind of perspective. But, you know, from my perspective and thinking, I'm also thinking along, you know, California being sort of on the Pacific Rim, right? And there are deep relationships between, say, for instance, California Indians and Kanaka people because of the histories of violence because of the histories of, you know, the gold rush and, agriculture. And, you know, there's just like, you know, these are complex relationships, but there are ones that are brought together because of what someone like Jody Berg calls the transitive empire, right? It's that simplifying process that has put indigenous peoples all around the world into close intimacies with each other. And so I think like the question of indigeneity for me is about understanding how to work across those differences, to understand what, how each space sort of requires its own, you know, forms of resistance, as well as, thinking about how the things that the settler state has tried to get rid of has still taken up space in other ways that we can find, you know, like our, you know, social and political forms are still here in various ways. And so thinking about, indigeneity becomes really important, you know. And so I've found a lot of really amazing kinship across California, Indian, and Palestinian relationships through that lens. And so that's at least for me, that's a kind of entry way into thinking about the importance of that term.
Oh, thank you both. And in a way, I just want to ask a kind of follow-up question, since I know, Ali, you write about Palestine in relation to Israel's high-tech war and deployment of drones, autonomous weapons, artificial intelligence, and so forth. But as you said, you've lived in Hawaii, you did your research there, which is a huge concentration of an occupation by U.S. military. And Mark, I know you visited Palestine on at least one occasion. And I'm curious, how you think about similarities and differences in terms of actually witnessing what's going on, what you actually see. For listeners who have perhaps not been to neither site, what you see that carries across the grounds, these similarities that you both beautifully expressed in more analytical terms. But when you're in Hawaii, Ali, for example, does the presence of the U.S. military there impact you as a kind of reminder of the, you know, impact of the Israeli occupying forces in historic Palestine? Or Mark, I mean, were you walking around Palestine and recognizing the walls, the presence of an occupying force, and of course the traces of destruction day on a daily basis? So I'm just curious how this manifests for you to inhabit spaces that are in relation through the phenomenon of occupation and devastation. Let me start with you, Mark.
Yes.
So the first thing I guess that I want to say about that, and I think it's maybe relevant also to thinking about where we are right now in relationship to Gaza, to Lebanon. The U.S. and Israel feel like twin projects that are deeply connected in material ways, but also deeply connected in ideological ways, as related to what I was talking about with being sort of like settler colonial outposts. But what I think was so striking for me when I had the chance to visit the West Bank and Jerusalem, you know, was how the things that I've had to learn how to like kind of see through the normalization of the United States, how much more overt those processes were, right? And obviously within the context of Gaza, far, far more overt. And especially as someone who like has focused a lot on the history of genocide in California, right? And sort of thinking through like the forms of violence that are taking place and, you know, how they're sort of being justified and the kinds of discourses that are being used to talk about them. The way I've begun to think about it is, the Hasbara has failed like significantly, right? It's just, I think that one of the sort of most amazing things that I sort of experienced was just how deep, how sort of high level the kind of political discourse was when I visited Palestine. You know, just the understandings were so phenomenal and gave me so much insight, and be able to come back and try to understand what it is that the U.S. is doing, right, through its imperial projects. as well as its relationship to Israel. You know, and so it's almost like what I'm beginning to see is that as the Hasbara fails, as the kind of like abnormalization of Israel is taking place, there's a kind of reflection back on this kind of twin project where the United States, and this is why I think the United States is so invested in keeping up this sort of media scape, which is focused on trying to make whatever, you know, Israel does seem like a justified, rational thing, that it's because the United States is equally as sort of abnormal as Israel, right? As a settler colonial country, there is no justification for anything that the U.S. has done in its past in relationship to Native Americans, as well as sort of globally. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, attempt to be this kind of imperial global police force. I think that that's one of the things that I've noticed, is that it's given me this really profound lens into thinking about and like really seeing a space like California very differently, a space where California Indians, I think to this day, are still sort of largely invisible, right? I mean, there's investigations going on into the genocide that took place here, and there's no political, no public, no media discussion about this whatsoever. It's just going on amongst California Indian people. No one else pays any attention to it. So I think, yeah, I think that failing of Hasbara is really starting to reveal the United States.
Thank you, Mark. I'm also thinking of those moments of failure and those moments of failure that we experience every day. I feel that my kind of Palestinian upbringing and, let's say, being taught how to practice my Palestinianness kind of primed me to encounter the world in a certain way. And I honestly felt that Palestinianness in those moments of disconnection from the Hawaii that I was supposed to become part of when I moved there. You know, the institutions, the state, the tourism, how to move. You know, there, how to orient myself. All those moments suddenly became moments where you could just experience this discomfort, disconnection, but also in that sense, also a desire to connect with something else. And because of that, you know, just you begin to look for traces for things to follow that maybe can lead you to somewhere, something, someone. Fortunately, I was very fortunate to have a lot of people around me who helped me navigate, you know, that world. Because all of those disconnections became moments that you can cultivate into really kind of affective bonds and attachments with really a different project, you know. A different project, and the also attachment to the people who stand in and for that project. This not only allows you to have a critical sense of the things around you, not to, let's say, allow the settler colony to circulate in and through you, you know, really allows you to have, at least for me, it allowed me to have a reorientation towards Palestine that was, let's say, not contained within the boundaries of Palestine itself. The Palestine that I visited when I was young, I went there every summer, every other summer. And those experiences suddenly became kind of points of reference to experiences that I started having in Hawaii and in North America. I think these are moments where you begin to not just theorize, but also practice a different kind of world. And I wanted to, or I hope that I was able to bring that into my scholarship, but also in kind of my my everyday, which is, of course, one of the biggest challenges we have, how to divest from, you know, the structures that we're plugged into and really cultivate those moments into, you know, new ways of sustaining life that I hope can bring us more together.
Absolutely. And on this notion of the lived, by any definition, we both kind of touched on this already, the United States and Palestine are settler colonies with histories of genocide, ethnic cleansing, as well as dispossession and cultural destruction. Israel, with the ardent support of the Biden administration, has intensified its genocide and in less often noticed ways its dispossession of Palestinians in the West Bank over this past year in a very accelerated fashion. What's particularly extraordinary about this ongoing genocide is how it bleeds into our everyday. It's live streamed as a live stream genocide. Mark, I know you've written about how inhabiting a post-apocalyptic world is the everyday experience of California Native peoples, even if it's not live streamed. And I'm curious to know how both of you think about this uncanny integration of our encounter with genocide into a mediated normality that is very, and this very phrase of ongoing, unwittingly captures. I mean, and especially I'm interested in how you think it's encountered particularly by Indigenous peoples and other colonized populations of whom this could be said to belong to their history and present and not just an emerging future. That is to say, how does this seep into the everyday lives? What is seen and what is not actually seen? Mark.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I mean, this is, I think, a really hard part of the conversation is talking about all the things that people have seen, you know, over, you know, since October 7th last year. And, you know, one of the things I actually wrote a chapter in my book on the concept of genocide and forms of recognition, and I have a very complicated relationship to that term for, I think, for obvious reasons, but, you know, the international legal frameworks that exist, you know, many of the laws that, you know, have been created around that, as well as the sort of forms of recognition, the types of evidence, what, you know, gets considered, you know, to contribute to the discourse of acknowledging that a genocide takes place, operates through these like Western liberal human frameworks, right? I mean, this is something I think a lot of people know. And so it really puts a lot of pressure on what it means to actually talk about forms of violence, right? But I was finishing that chapter, you know, and trying to get the book off right as the genocide against Gazans was starting to take place, you know, and it really forced me to begin to think about what it means to produce that kind of evidence. I think that's the thing that was really stuck in my mind. And I just have to note, like, the on-the-ground journalist there, I mean, I can't even begin to express, you know, like, I don't even know what to say it is. Like, it's not gratitude. That's a horrible thing to say. I don't, like, it's a necessity. Like, what they did was an absolute fundamental necessity, and have been doing, you know, in order to make the world see, like, what is happening, you know. And it was a very difficult thing for me because, like, I've, you know, read all of this, you know, the archives, the, you know, the language that was produced in order to justify violence against Indigenous people, specifically for talking in California with the genocide here, you know, the effects that it's had on communities, you know, everyone, right, including children, you know, all of the casual forms of violence that took place, you know, from the U.S. military as well as settlers, right? And so I had like a deep sort of knowledge of all of these kinds of things. But to see this sort of unfold and on the internet, and to see, you know, the way that, you know, literal bodies, you know, as well as the destruction of society, culture, forms of memory, you know, the attacks on universities, the attacks on libraries, the attacks on mosques, like to watch it like unfold and to see like the level of destruction, I think was it profoundly changed, I think, everything. Like I honestly